Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to the first real session of this semester's A. Richard Newton Distinguished Innovator Lecture Series in Life as an Entrepreneur. And I'm very, very glad to present today's speaker to you. This is it. This is the first commercially available microprocessor that Intel brought to market in the early 70s. And as you all know, this and the many, many generations thereafter have fundamentally shaped and changed our lives, the way we live, the way we learn everything. I'm very proud to say that we have the co-inventor of the first commercially available microprocessor, Ted Hoffier, with us. And before I turn over to him, a few highlights from his bio. After Intel, he spent a lot of time over at Atari, and then later at a consulting firm called Techlicon. And I know he will go into more details on all of this, and more importantly, how he made the decisions that led him to where he went. With that, over to you.
Thank you very much. Just like to talk a little bit about some of my experience in technology and hopefully take a look at where it's going to go. And I hope you're able to get some value from it. I've been pretty lucky in my life and had a chance to do some very interesting work. And in the case of the microprocessor, enjoyed having it recognized a number of places. And so you might say, well, how did I get involved in this? How did I get to do invention and so on? I could say, well, I was just very lucky. Now, that's not very helpful. But actually, how did I get lucky? And that is curiosity. And that's something I think is a lesson that we can learn, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about it. Now, I use the term here, you know, they used to say curiosity killed the cat. Well, it's been beneficial to this cat. Now, that's a term that was used in my generation. Today, it might be equivalent to, let's say, rock star. I don't know how many of you have seen the ad, this is a portion of it, that Intel has put out, but if you look down at the bottom, they've identified me as a rock star. So I use the term that way. But let me give an example of how curiosity has worked to my benefit. And it goes way back. Right about the end of World War II, I was about 9 years old, and I got interested in chemistry primarily because I had an uncle who was 12 years old, older than I am. He had just come back from World War II in the Pacific and went to the University of Rochester, and I grew up outside of Rochester, New York, to become a chemical engineer. And he would give me his chemistry textbooks when he was through with them. And I thought, well, chemistry really sounds great. But then he gave me a subscription to Popular Science magazine when I was about 12 years old, and in it I see an ad for a free Allied radio catalog. Well, I knew nothing about radio or electronics, but I thought, gee, it might be fun to learn about it. And a free catalog for the cost of a stamp, I can get started. Well, I sent for the catalog, and then they had very inexpensive books on electronics, so I started ordering those. And before long, while I was in high school, I was doing pretty good with electronics. I'll tell you a little bit more about how it panned out. But I ended up with a career in electronics. And it all goes back to that curiosity about radio way back then. Now, as I said, I did quite a bit of work with electronics while I was in high school. I graduated high school and went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. That first summer between high school and going to college, I was able to get a summer job in an electronics lab. My father worked at a different part of this company. It was General Railway Signal Company in Rochester, New York. But he got me an interview, and the work I'd done in electronics essentially got me a job there. My second year, I was assigned to work with two engineers, and we were working on what was called an audio frequency track circuit. This was for railway signaling. And this particular circuit I was just assigned to put it together, but I was curious about how it worked and wanted to know more about it. And it had a circuit, an oscillator that generated 10 kilohertz, and it worked on the basis that it would only see a train that was fairly close to a feed point because of the inductance of the rails would make the train invisible if it was farther away. And that was the goal. Safe failure was not to detect the train. Well, anyway, in looking at what they were having me build, I realized it had an amplifier in it, and amplifiers can oscillate, and that could give a false positive, which was an unsafe failure mode. So I suggested, gee, how about if we just use a very sensitive relay, because ultimately that's what we're doing, is picking a relay. If it's so sensitive, we don't need an amplifier, and then we can guarantee it won't oscillate. And I made one other suggestion having to do with a capacitor to do some tuning. At the end of that summer, the engineers tell me that they're going to be filing for a patent on this system. They like the suggestions I made, and they're naming me as a co-inventor. This is actually from the patent. There's a third name there. You look at the date, October 5th, 1955. That was just a few weeks before my 18th birthday. So here I am, not even 18, and I'm an inventor. So that had a big influence. Now, I graduated from RPI. Again, curiosity at work. I've never been west of Niagara Falls. I decided to go to school in California at that other Institute of the Bay Area, Stanford University. So I come out here to do graduate work and got my PhD in 62 and stayed on at Stanford working as a researcher on government contracts in what today would be called neural networks. It turned out that periodically a recruiter from Fairchild Semiconductor would come by to talk to us. And he wanted to know about the different students in our group who might be a good candidate for their company. And I was curious about the semiconductor industry, so every time he came around, I would try to pick his brain about what was going on in semiconductors. And I had done some work with core memory, and it seemed to me that maybe it was time to look at semiconductor memory. At least that, in these discussions, that's what happened. Well, in 1968, I get a phone call from someone who introduces themselves. I'd met him once before, so I knew who he was. He announced he was named Bob Noyce. I knew he was the head of Fairchild Semiconductor, but he told me he had just left, and he was going to be starting a new company. Didn't tell me much about it, but would I be interested in talking to him about a possible position in the new company? And I was probably ready to leave that academic world and go into the world of business. So I said, sure, and actually ended up interviewing at his home. One of the first questions he asked me, what do I think the next big area for semiconductors would be? And based on those conversations I'd had with that recruiter, I answered memory. I didn't know that was what Intel was going to do. This is from an article that appeared in the Palo Alto newspaper in August of 68. Bob Noyce is on the left, Gordon Moore is on the right, and this tells about how they're going to be forming a new company. Now, Intel's goal was semiconductor memory. About a little over a year after the company was founded, the director of marketing and I published an article, and we predicted we would get the cost of semiconductor memory down to a penny a bit by 1972. And we figured by that time, we will be able to take over from core memory. People will buy semiconductor memory instead of magnetic cores, because they were presumably hard to get down to that price range. We met that goal. I actually have price lists from 1972 showing 1,000-bit memory chips for around $7 in modest quantities. But look at what's happened today. You go out and buy a memory chip for a digital camera or something like that, and you typically get anywhere from 10 to maybe 40 million bits of memory for every penny you spend. Where has there been technology that has made progress like that? Well, one of the situations that happened at Intel, we knew that it was going to take a while before we would be successful in selling semiconductor memory to the big computer houses. And so it might be a while before we would be generating revenue. And Intel was started with only $3 million in financing, which today would seem like a pittance, but it wasn't going to last forever. So one of the ways a semiconductor house deals with that is they do custom work. In other words, you build something to the specifications of a specific customer, and presumably as soon as you can make silicon, he's going to be ready to buy it. So that was, we ended up agreeing to do LSI for a set of calculators to be sold under the name BusyCom. And it was April of 69 when we agreed to do that, and about June of that year, three engineers come from Japan, and they've got the design about ready to transfer. Now, I've by this time had some experience with a number of computers, an IBM 1620, an IBM 1130, Digital Equipment PDP-8, and I've programmed and looked at the insides of them, done interfaces to them, and so on. So I'm curious, what's in a calculator? And as I look over this, the design of that's being presented to us, I'm really getting concerned. I know what the cost targets are, and it looks like it may be difficult to meet those cost targets. The calculator was to be based on shift register memory at 6 transistors per bit. That serial type of memory really complicates the control logic. Then on top of that, there were issues. It was binary coded decimal arithmetic and so on. And I started raising the question, why should this calculator be so much more complicated than a computer? And I don't know if any of you are familiar with a PDP-8 computer, but it is a remarkably simple architecture. So I started expressing some concerns to Bob Noyce about this calculator project, and he suggested, if you have any way to simplify it, you know, investigate. Go ahead and look at it. Normally you don't argue with a customer. You just do what he wants. But it seemed to me that we could, for one thing, by going from shift register to dynamic RAM, where instead of having, it would be typically like 100 microseconds to scan the shift register, I can get into a dynamic RAM in a microsecond or two. If I made a simple enough general purpose computer architecture, then I could not only do all the calculator functions, but even the peripheral functions, things like scanning a keyboard and operating a printer, using programming, and put the complexity into memory, which is easy to generate and easy to make changes later on if you have errors. And so that led to a proposal for a very simple 4-bit machine. That was made a formal proposal in September of 69, and we got the go-ahead from the Japanese calculator company. In fact, there was actually a meeting where an associate of mine, Stan Mazur, and I presented our approach, and the three engineers from Japan presented their approach to the management of the calculator company in a meeting held in Mountain View, and the management said, we like the Intel approach. And so we were committed as of October of 69 to go ahead with that design. Now, we had a contact a little bit later in December of 69 from a company in Texas that came to us initially asking for a memory chip for a processor they were building. And in looking at it, we said, gee, why just do the memory? That processor is not that much more difficult to make than the 4004, which was our 4-bit processor. So we proposed to them that they do that product And that ultimately became our second microprocessor, the 8008. Might point out that the 8008 led to the 8080, the 8080, an upgrade was the 8086 and 8088, then the 286 and the 386, and then the Pentiums, and today their PCs are running on what's really a glorified, souped-up 8008. Of course, really souped up. Now, we had working parts on the microcomputers. And there were actually four chips in the set, the CPU, a read-only memory, a read-write memory, and a chip that was basically a shift register used for I/O expansion. And we had those in February of 71, but there was a huge struggle going on within Intel. Intel saw its market as being big computer companies. And they're concerned that if we start offering computers, those big computer companies will see us not as a supplier, but as a competitor. And the other issue was, how do we support these? And so there were major, major decisions, and it took all of 1971, basically, to finally make the decision to go ahead. And I even remember a meeting in Bob Noyce's office where he said, we're not ready to make a decision. And I say, every time you delay it, you're making a decision not to announce. And finally, it was announced. So one of the things to remember, you can have a great product, a great invention, but selling it is more important, and you got to sell it to the people that can do something about it than even designing it or building it in the first place. Well, 1972, 4004s were selling at $60. And in my day, a lot of people did their first computer programming on an IBM 1620, and our 4004 would run the problems at about the same speed as the 1620. The difference was the 1620, a decade earlier, had cost us $2,500 a month to lease. And now you could buy a processor for $60, quantity one. 8008s we charged $120 for. And microprocessor took off. Was a very successful product. Feedback from the 8008 led to the 8080. That was a very successful product, and really the first one that competed with the mini computer. However, then Bob Noyce asked me, would I look at another area? Would I look at the telephone industry and see if there was something that Intel technology could do there? Well, I needed to know more about telephony. I knew essentially nothing about it. And I also needed to know more about what our capabilities were. I had done modeling work and so on to help build simulators for use in the design of MOS products. But I needed to know what our capabilities were, because this looked like we would be pushing the technology into areas that would be quite different. So one of the things I needed to know, or felt I really wanted to know, was if we make resistors, you know, how well do they match? I could use these to advantage in amplifiers and so on. Now, I never considered myself the expert on MOS technology. There were people that had many more years of experience than I had, so I went to my boss, who was supposedly the expert. And I asked him, if I print two resistors on a chip side by side, how well will they match? And his answer was, not very well. I said, I don't want that, you know, qualitative. I want a quantitative number. Tell me, what percentage deviation can I expect? And then he admitted he didn't know. Well, maybe we can find out. Again, curiosity at work. Turns out Intel periodically runs test wafers. And each test wafer has a whole bunch of identical die sites on it. And you get a hold of a wafer before it's been cut up. And each die site has one resistor. So I don't have two resistors side by side. But what I do is I make a measurement of all the resistors on the wafer and look at it as a plot. And the first thing I notice, it's a very smooth gradient across the wafer. Well, that ought to be useful. A little bit of mathematical analysis, and I can measure how far from a smooth line do these points, you know, how much do they deviate from that point? It turns out, and it later was measured and confirmed, the resistors measure within less than a percent deviation if they're printed side by side. And that led to a design for a D-Day converter and a whole bunch of other things using MOS technology. Now, sometimes you really do get lucky. I was really interested in what we can do with MOS in the analog world. And there's one guy who is the foremost authority. His name was Paul Gray, and he was a professor right here at Berkeley. And we managed to persuade Paul to come and consult for us. And he and his students had been working in this area, and then it turned out he had a sabbatical coming up, and so he spent that at Intel, and it helped Intel produce what I believe were the first commercially available telephone codecs and the switch capacitor filters that went with them. And it always seemed to me this was a very beneficial relationship we had. It was good for the students here at Berkeley who were working in that area, and it got these products into the market, and it made a whole new field of the switch capacitor work. Now, around 1983, Intel had become very focused primarily on the computer business. They moved the telecom activity to Arizona in 1980, and I didn't want to go there. And then it turned out I was recruited by Atari, and Atari had some fantastic work going on, labs around the country really doing some very, very interesting applications of computers and expanded graphics and so on. The trouble is, Atari did not have the kind of discipline, primarily due to, at Intel, Andy Grove ran a very tight ship. You'd say he had an iron fist, and he made sure everybody, you know, paid attention to every fine detail. Atari was very disorganized. It was owned by Warner Communications, and it ended up being sold about a year and a half after I joined Atari. So I became an independent consultant. But it turned out that one of the people that worked with me at Atari started a company named Teclacon to consult for attorneys in intellectual property. And so I joined Teclacon, and I was with them for 20 years until I finally retired in 2007. Now, a couple of lessons I think could be learned here. For one thing, to get an invention into the field, you've got to be stubborn. You've got to be persistent. In other words, I say, it isn't a fault, it's a necessity. Another thing is, in your career, you'll hear information that's presumably presented as fact. A couple of them. To do analog work, you need to have bipolar processing. MOS isn't useful. MOS is too noisy, etc. Well, at Intel we proved it. Paul Gray helped prove it, that MOS was just fine, had some tremendous advantages. It makes an almost perfect analog switch, for example. Selling an idea is much harder than developing it. And so you got to be a salesman. And the other thing, all my career, I have gathered what most people would think of as useless information, and I've almost found all of it useful at some point. So it pays to collect it. Now, there's a quote, I remember hearing this, and I looked it up, and it's, you read it up here. If a man write a better book or whatever, the main thing is to build a better mousetrap. It says the world will make a beaten path through his door. That is just not true. And I've seen too often, you've got to sell products. That is the most important aspect of invention, is get the product out there where people will use it. Now, I'd like to take a look at some future trends. One of the issues is how far can semiconductor technology advance? And there's some other areas of things that are going on in the world that I think may be worth taking a look at, you know, global dynamics and climate change, population growth, and so on, and maybe the influence some of these may have on technology. Now, one of the things that's been going on is term scaling. In 1974, Bob Dennard, a fellow we know from IBM, pointed out in a paper that, particularly with MOS technology, making things smaller has tremendous advantages. If you make the linear dimension of your circuit half as much, well, you've got a given size piece of silicon, you can get four times as many circuits on that piece of silicon. But each circuit runs twice as fast and runs at one quarter of the power. So you're getting eight times the bang per buck if you make things half size. Well, that's what we've been doing. Actually, it's now about 35 years of scaling since 1974 to the present. We were dealing with about 10,000 nanometer geometries then. Now we're in the 45 going to 30 nanometers today. In terms of speed, we were running about a megahertz then. We're now in the multi-gigahertz range today for the speeds. 4004 was about 2,000, just a little over 2,000 transistors, and we considered that aggressive for the technology today. Now we put a billion transistors on a chip. And as I pointed out, we've run memory down to the point where it's, you know, fractions of a millionth of a penny per bit. In fact, to point out, if you looked at the memory cost back in 72, to store the information on one printed page would have been about $300 worth of semiconductor memory. Today, it's like 1,000 times more expensive to put print on paper than it is to put that data in semiconductor memory. Now, one of the issues is we've been at this scaling game for some 35 years. Is it at its limit? And some death reports were premature. I've made the slide a while back, but here's 2004, a researcher at IBM announces scaling at 130 nanometers, we won't go any smaller than that. And a few months later, Intel announces 65 nanometer technology. So that was a little premature. But we know it has to end someday. We just cannot continue to make things much smaller. Now, I did a calculation back around 1982 or so when I was still at Intel. And based on signal-to-noise considerations, I figured the smallest that you can go is in the 5 to 10 nanometer range. So we are getting very close to that limit. And what happens at that point? You make your circuit so small you have to run at about a quarter volt. You have about 25 millivolts of noise due to thermal effects and the effect of a single electron on that small geometry. And at that point, you're running about a 20 dB signal-to-noise ratio. And if you try to make things smaller, your signal-to-noise gets so bad you can't even make a reliable logic circuit. And redundancy doesn't help because now you've increased the area to make redundant circuits. You do better to make a bigger circuit than to try to have circuits redundant in voting. So I think one of the things we're going to see is there will be some change in the semiconductor industry because we're coming to the end of scaling. On the other hand, look at the computing power we have today, and I question whether we're really using it all that effectively. There's so many problems that I would think that I would have thought we'd have solutions by now. You know, like computers will understand natural language or do translation instantly. And we've got the speed to do it. I just don't think we have the knowledge. Now, one of the things that's in the press a lot these days is global climate change. And we're getting away from maybe semiconductors and integrated circuits. But you look at, since the industrial age, we've been pulling carbon, either in the form of coal or oil, out of the ground and dumping it in the atmosphere. And that's increasing the mostly carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If you look at the rate at which we've been burning oil and coal, it takes about something like 200 years to double the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, assuming that nothing removes it. And maybe a bigger impact is the fact that we have been cutting down rainforests, and that helps us. Those rainforests are one of the things that help to cleanse the atmosphere. And I question how much we really know about atmospheric behavior. I grew up, as I mentioned, outside of Rochester, New York, upstate New York. And we learned that 10,000 years ago, our area was under a sheet of ice. I don't think we can blame human activity for the warming of the Earth that took place over those few thousand years where we went from an ice age to basically the kind of climate we have today. But one area I think there's really a lot of need for is better modeling of the atmosphere so we know what the impact of all of this activity, particularly burning fossil fuels, is going to be. It's getting kind of scary. An even bigger issue may be population growth. And in the last century, the world population grew by roughly a factor of four, from about 1.5 billion people to 6 billion people. And in that same time, we nearly doubled the life expectancy from roughly 45 years to about 80 years. So that's like an 8 times burden on the planet in terms of the human population. I don't know if any of you watch Bill Maher, the comedian, on HBO, and he's always, well, not always, but quite often waxes eloquent about how so many Americans seem to be sick, they're on medication, they, in other words, seem to have all sorts of problems. Well, it's probably true to some extent. If you went back a century and you took someone, let's say, 71 years after their birth date, they wouldn't be on medicine. They wouldn't have any medical apparatus to deal with. They'd be in their graves. They would be dead. And that's one of the things that medical technology has done for us, and I'm a testament to that. I point out, I've had my third pacemaker put in. Each one lasts about 9 years. So lucky to have a doctor find a cardiac problem, an occasional minor difficulty of cardiac arrest that is now taken care of by a pacemaker. 8 years ago, I was diagnosed with 2 different kinds of cancer, prostate cancer and renal cell carcinoma. The renal cell carcinoma was found only because after the prostate cancer, my doctor said, let's do a CT scan. Now, there's a piece of technology that didn't exist a century ago. And in that CT scan, they found this tumor. In most cases, those tumors are never found until it's too late to do anything about it. They have essentially no symptoms. In my case, some very advanced surgery took care of that. So this is a case where technology has really increased life expectancy, and some of those medications that Bill Maher complains about also help to improve the quality of life and extend it. But if you look back and consider that the last century was also the end of a millennium, what would happen if that population growth were to continue for the next millennium? Now, various historians say we've had about 60,000 years of, Homo sapiens on the planet, 15,000 years of that in the New World in the Western Hemisphere, maybe 5,000 years of recorded history. Let's look at the next 1,000 years and continue the population growth. How much area will there be for each human being on the planet? How much land area? And it turns out, no more than the area of the soles of your feet. We cannot continue the way we have, certainly not for another 1,000 years. But an area where I think there's some real room for innovation and technology and some new businesses, is in carbon control. It really seems questionable to continue dumping carbon into the atmosphere. But hydrocarbon fuels have a real advantage in terms of portability, of carrying energy around. If we could reprocess the CO2 we generate and make more fuels that way, we could end up presumably doing a closed cycle. The other thing is people have been talking about, you know, getting the hydrogen by reacting carbon. It got the same problem. It should probably be done with electrolysis of water, so you get hydrogen and oxygen, and you can put the oxygen back in the atmosphere, and you've got a pretty much closed cycle. And the other thing is a lot of work on biofuels that could be done. And when I was a kid, we had a cow, and we grew corn. We ate the edible part of the corn, and when you husk it, the cow got the husks off the corn. I learned much later that a cow cannot digest cellulose, but it has a bacteria that lives in its stomach. That does the job. Presumably the same is true of termites. Termites eat wood, but they can't digest it. It's a bacteria that does the digestion. Why can't we come up with a system that duplicates that and essentially convert that cellulose, which is polymerized glucose, into sugar and make ethanol out of it and do like they do down in Brazil and run all their cars on ethanol instead of on oil that we have to import from the Middle East? Well, I think my time is coming to an end. I look around and I think we've got lots of problems that need solutions, and this is just a very few of them. And these problems are the seeds that make entrepreneurs successful and give them ideas. And so one of the questions, who's going to help do this? And hopefully you will be some of it. And before I leave, I would just like to also say one other way. I was very lucky. 34 years ago, I met my wife, and we just celebrated our 32nd anniversary. So I'd like to introduce my wife, Judy. I guess we have time for questions. Or
thank you very much. Questions? Please raise your hand and I'll pass you the mic. I have one question. You've obviously seen Silicon Valley develop and change and invent itself and reinvent itself. What do you think is going to be the future? What's going to be next for this Bay Area economy?
Well, as I've said, this is one area I really don't know what's going to happen. I am concerned that we have a tendency in business to just continue along a given path. And hopefully there will be people looking at this more seriously and figuring out how to adapt the business to take into account when we no longer can have this, 30% improvement in performance every year that we've been used to. We are likely to come to an end of that probably in a decade or so. It's going to become more difficult and more expensive to push into these other areas. That may be another factor that will slow the progress. Generally, as you approach a limit, you approach it asymptotically. So it takes you a lot longer to get those last few nanometers. But this is something I really don't have a good feeling for, and I would think this is an area where there's going to be a need for some really new ideas as to how that business will survive. And I don't really see that much that's going to replace it, though. I mean, people talk about learning from biological systems, making fuzzier logic and so on. But we've been working in that area for quite some time, and so far I don't see the products on the market. And one of the things Bob Noyce used to make a certain point, and I think it's one to think about. He said, you have a successful business and it's making a profit, and from that profit you are able to invest in R&D. if you don't have the business developed and you don't have that profit stream, where is the money going to come from to pay for that R&D? In other words, that is a significant factor. And the idea of even, in his case, he was talking about silicon processing, with all these companies making silicon and investing billions of dollars in improving silicon processing. And then along comes gallium arsenide or something, and these are little companies that only have a few million dollars. They don't have the kind of money to continue developing that. And unless they get a huge chunk of market, they may end up drying up before they're able to spend on R&D. So it's a real factor to think of in looking at a business.
Thank you. Questions?
Thanks. Mr. Roth, when you come up with this disruptive innovation, at that time, what was your forecast on the impact it would have been?
Could you tell the forecast?
Could you forecast at that time, like the impact you would have made?
You mean on the microprocessor?
Yes.
Our view at the time we announced the microprocessor was really the market that today is referred to as embedded control. And in fact, it's something that is often overlooked by the media. And in fact, I've given talks to point that out. And, you know, the media thinks of desktop or notebook computers as where all microprocessors go. The actual numbers that go into hidden places, and like somebody pointed out, I'm an example of embedded control because I've got a microprocessor in me running my heart. So I think it was a few years back, there's a group called Microprocessor Forum, and they brought a number of, might call the early pioneers of microprocessors together and looking back at the business. And Masatoshi Shima, he was one of the Japanese engineers who came to us, had come from Japan. And now at that time, we were probably talking about maybe 20 million PCs a year. And he said the usage in Japan of embedded controllers, basically, was 600 million units a year, just in Japan alone. So, I mean, that is something that the media seems very much unaware of, even to the point we were recognized at the Inventors Hall of Fame back in 1996, I think it was. And when they announced it, they told the audience, you may have driven here in an automobile designed with the aid of a notebook computer. Even they didn't realize. Probably everybody who had driven to that ceremony had driven in an automobile that was running under computer control, but not aware of it. And when I came to California, and you'd look down from the hills at the freeways, you could see them looking like tubes of smog in the summertime. We've made our automobiles run much cleaner. Many steps have been taken, but one of the things is running the cars under computer control. That helps.
Mr. Hoff, you mentioned several times in your lecture that you were very lucky, but I'm curious as to what kind of steps that you could maybe expand on how you can position yourself for success that made these opportunities happen, either in terms of acquiring like a mentor or doing research or, like you said, a magazine.
You know, this is a, you know, if I understand your question, it's like for some reason I have just found myself being curious. I don't know where it came from, but it goes back a long time. Probably one of the first things, my uncle I mentioned, who was 12 years older than I, came in one day. I was probably 6 years old or something. And he mixes together two colorless liquids, and he pours them together, and they turn bright red. And I think, I'd like to know how to do that. And later on, I learned how to do that. I mean, phenolphthalein solution and alkali. But there was something about knowing how things work. And even one of the frustrations today, when you think of when the IBM PC came out, and you bought an IBM PC, and I bought one of the early ones, you could buy a book that had essentially all the information, complete schematics, the BIOS code, everything you needed to know. So you could go in and play with that and know exactly what's going on. Well, today, Microsoft and its infinite wisdom has decided nobody should know that information. And even when you buy a piece of code, you agree that you will not disassemble it and look at the code. I mean, it goes to that far. So there's a change, and I'm frustrated that I don't get to know what's going on exactly. And it becomes twice as frustrating when the computer does what I don't want it to do, and it's hard to find out how to make it do what you want it to do.
One more question.
What's the biggest mistake that you see young entrepreneurs make? What's the biggest mistake that you see young entrepreneurs make, and how do you go and avoid that?
It's hard to say which is the biggest mistake that they make. One of the things is falling in love with the technology and not really listening to the customer. I mean, ultimately, for the entrepreneur to be successful, you've got to sell your product. And that means you have to understand the customer's needs. And I ran into that at Intel. One of the things we did in the telecom group, and it was not a successful product, we did a digital signal processing chip called the 2920. And we knew it wasn't quite right. Now, I would travel with marketing people, and the marketing people were so interested in selling the 2920 that every time a customer tried to tell us what was wrong with it, the marketing people would interrupt and try to tell them why it was such a good product. And I wanted to hear what was wrong with it. Hopefully, I wouldn't make the same mistakes the next time. And it's that not listening to the customer and understanding his problem, I think, is probably the biggest error that you can make.
Great. With that, thank you very much for being here today.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.